There's a number you may have heard me throw around, and it's 17.8. 17.8%, to be exact. That is how much of our gross domestic product America spends on health care.
More Americans are going to get hurt unless we do something.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. So yeah, any major change to healthcare policy in this country is a big economic deal, and pretty much the definition of where the economy meets real life. After all, not much is more personal than health. So that's where we're starting, with the release this week of the Senate's draft healthcare bill. A vote is expected next week, but what are four things you need to know? Marketplace's health reporter Dan Gorenstein breaks it down. Point one.
If you're one of the more than 10 million people getting a tax subsidy to help you buy insurance on the exchanges, you're in for a change. The Senate plan would shrink the size of that subsidy, meaning you get a skimpier plan and it's going to cost you more.
Point two.
If you're on Medicaid, and more than 75 million Americans are, then there's a good chance you'll see changes where you live. This bill cuts as much as $1 trillion out of the program over 10 years. That probably means states will either shrink eligibility, limit services, or cut payments to doctors and hospitals. Most likely, it would be all of the above.
Point three.
If you earn more than $200,000 a year, this is good news for you, at least financially. You'll be in line for a tax break. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities ran some numbers, and if you earn more than $1 million a year, you'll get annual tax cuts averaging more than $50,000.
And point four.
If you live in a state that didn't expand Medicaid, and 19 states haven't, including Texas and Florida, and you earn $12,000 a year or less, the Senate plan would offer you a financial subsidy to help buy insurance. Right now, that's not an option under Obamacare. The question is whether you'd be able to afford the deductibles and copays that come with this kind of a plan.
Dan Gorenstein will be following all the twists and turns of the healthcare debate, and you'll hear it all on Marketplace. While the Senate works on the new healthcare bill, a growing number of Americans are tackling their medical costs with crowdfunding. A 2015 poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation and the New York Times found that 1 in 5 Americans with health insurance had trouble paying some health-related expenses, like this woman.
My name is Molly Young. I live in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm a 30-year-old breast cancer patient. I was diagnosed in February. On February 24th of this year, I was 29 at the time.
I had actually just started on a health insurance plan on January 1st that I purchased through the Maryland Marketplace and was getting subsidy from the ACA to help make that more affordable.
Luckily, a lot of the biggest medical costs have been covered by my insurance, but there's so much you just don't anticipate in terms of the other bills that don't stop. If I don't keep up with my insurance premiums, I would lose my insurance, and then I'd be really in trouble. I have lots of appointments to drive to. That's gas money. There's days, even when I've felt healthy, that I've had to miss work simply because I have to be at such and such an appointment. I work as a performer and a teacher. I do my taxes as a self-employed musician. Even though I work usually 7 days a week, there's not a single job that I have that provides benefits or any paid sick leave. So every time I take a day off for treatment or surgery, anything, I've had to just eat the cost and not get that income.
The day Molly Young announced on Facebook that she had cancer, two of her friends started GoFundMe campaigns to help raise money for her.
The GoFundMe accounts were started, I think both my friends kind of wrote about it in their explanation, because I have no sick days. And I think for them, they were hoping that this might help me have some peace of mind on days that my body really does need a break, so that I wouldn't feel guilty about calling in, or I wouldn't feel like I had to push through on days when I really shouldn't be.
So one of the accounts got, I think, to 20,100, something like that. And the other one is still going. That one's for 8,000. So
for me right now, I haven't had to dip into that money yet, but it's been an enormous emotional relief. It's just been a really great way to have, like I said, have some peace of mind knowing that this isn't going to, you know, knock on wood, it's not going to throw me into absolute financial crisis for the rest of my life.
For many people like Young, the costs of their care can be overwhelming, even on the day they get bad news.
When I took that phone call and I learned that this was just going to completely uproot my whole life. I would say I spent maybe 10 seconds or so only freaking out about myself and whether or not I would die, and then immediately thought, oh my gosh, what happens if my health insurance goes away? My first concern was, what are the finances going to look like? What's going to get covered? What am I going to have to pay for? How am I going to do this? I already have student loan debt. I really couldn't afford cancer, to be honest. I have never seen myself as a charity case. I have a very hard time. I don't know how comfortable I'd be asking for money. Having that kind of taken on by some people for me was, I don't have enough words to describe what a relief that was. And it really allowed me to focus on what I had to do, which is the medical side. My number one job is to survive.
Young's not alone in using crowdfunding. According to a report from NerdWallet last year, GoFundMe, the largest company in the crowdfunding business, has raised $930 million in medical campaigns since its 2010 launch. When we reached out to GoFundMe, a spokesperson said it was hard to calculate how much of the $4 billion that have been raised on the site were for medical issues.
A lot of people who are using these sites don't know that most of them take a percentage of each campaign as a fee. You may feel like you're working with or donating to a fairly benevolent platform, but where there's financial struggle, there's often, you know, a corporate profit as well.
That's Nora Kenworthy, a professor of nursing and health studies at the University of Washington, Bothell. She and a colleague studied how Americans use crowdfunding for medical costs.
You know, we were really just trying to figure out what the lay of the land was, how people are using crowdfunding. What we're seeing, what we're kind of hypothesizing here is that crowdfunding is a bit of a kind of canary in the coal mine of the U.S. healthcare system, and that it tells us about the different kinds of gaps that people are falling through.
What kinds of needs are you seeing people raise money for?
The first type of campaign is people who have a single big medical crisis that they are trying to raise money for. For these people, the healthcare costs are simply unmanageable. They probably have health insurance, but it's just not enough. The second group of people are either uninsured or underinsured. So they're really turning to crowdfunding to help pay for big deductibles and large out-of-pocket costs. The last group is really families and individuals who have multiple and overlapping health and social crises that are going on in their lives. Oftentimes, they have multiple people in the family who are dealing with different illnesses. These are the people for whom crowdfunding is often least successful because it's hardest for them to articulate like a single solvable problem that can be kind of marketed to their networks.
When you mentioned everyday expenses, you know, not the sort of catastrophic accident that frankly might have been in my mind when I was thinking about these. What kind of expenses do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking of one family in the South whose page we looked at, and they had an elderly family member that they were trying to get out of intensive care and move home so that they could care for her. And they were fundraising for an air conditioning unit. Because it was unsafe to bring her home in the summer heat. You know, that's a really, I don't know, unsexy expense, right? But it's also a really essential one. And it points to the multiple ways that people are being asked to give care and fundraise for care in a system that doesn't help them with those expenses.
What's sort of the average that somebody raises in one of these campaigns? And what is, frankly, you know, a company, say GoFundMe, make off of them?
The average amount that was raised in the campaigns that we studied, which was a randomized sample of about 200 campaigns from across the U.S., the average was about $3,000. That seems like a lot of money, but it's really hardly enough to kind of prevent medical bankruptcy or pay much larger healthcare bills. And off of the top of that, GoFundMe would take a 5% cut in addition to credit card processing fees.
One of the things that's really interesting in your study is you have this line, this title, providing a worthy illness. I mean, what you showed is that it's not just about having a need, but kind of selling your need.
Right. So we found that crowdfunding campaigns seem to do best when people can focus on a single solvable problem and then very successfully market it to their existing social network. Then the other thing we saw is that, you know, it's really about telling a compelling, upbeat, promising story. And that requires a lot of social media skills and a lot of different kinds of literacies. And those kinds of skills accrue among certain sectors of the population more than they do in other groups.
What did you learn about the healthcare system in general doing this study? I mean, what sort of, you know, things did studying this highlight for you?
You know, despite the real gains in insurance coverage that we've seen under Obamacare, we do see the rise in crowdfunding for medical issues as a reflection of these existing inadequacies in our healthcare system. So, for example, we found that a disproportionate number of campaigns were in states that did not take the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, even in states that did take the expansion, the costs are really still high for a lot of people, and lots of folks are going underinsured.
You have a phrase here, the individual responsibility for survival. Well, what kind of issues does that highlight, do you think?
Well, I think this is reflective of a broader economic trend towards kind of what we're thinking of as, you know, flexible economies where people are more responsible for their own survival and have less of a social safety net. Unfortunately, in this particular crowdfunding economy, your responsibility for your survival links to your ability to market and promote your own illness. You know, it's also really important to underscore that the vast majority of crowdfunding campaigns don't go viral. In the campaigns that we looked at, only 10% of them reached the financial goal that they set for themselves. So, you know, it's not the life raft that we might think it is.
Nora Kenworthy is an assistant professor of nursing and health at the University of Washington, Bothell. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
In this part of the show, we're going to talk about energy, where it comes from and how we use it. Americans love political narratives about work and jobs that evoke or signal something. Over the last year, it was hard to escape the narrative of the coal miner.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal.
And I love the miners, and we're going to put the miners back to work, okay?
This will help turn this industry around. And I'm
See, the okay. Labor Department says we have 51,000 coal mining jobs in the country total.
He would take care of the coal miners. He took care of the coal companies, okay, but he hasn't done nothing for the miners yet.
We love our coal miners.
President Trump talks about coal miners a lot, and he's rolled back Obama-era regulations aimed at the mining industry. But here's the thing. Setting narratives aside, the numbers show coal is declining. Natural gas is cheaper to use to make electricity, and many of the people who have done this work don't see much of a future for themselves in coal.
My name is Gary Bentley. I'm a former underground miner from Wattsburg, Kentucky. I currently reside in Lexington, Kentucky. So I worked as an underground miner for 12 years. I started straight out of high school and started in the beginning as a contract miner. And then by the end of my career, I was working as a mine foreman doing safety inspections. Generally speaking, the average mine height was about 36 inches. So being 6'2", it was meant crawling a lot for most of my work day.
Why did you get into mining?
My original plans were not to work underground. It was to go to college. I actually wanted to work in education. But then, of course, being 18, 19 years old and earning $70,000 a year, I kind of got suckered into the industry and ended up staying. There's often a stereotype, and very unfortunate that our president has said this a few times, that coal miners are ignorant people. They don't know how to do anything else. But I've worked with guys that had degrees from good universities as computer programmers. I worked with a guy that was a college professor for 2 years and decided that he could make a better living for himself and be closer to his family by working underground. And it's not always about either not being able to do something else or not knowing how to. It's about being close to family, and when that's the only option you have, that's what you do. And it's also about the history of it. I mean, there's kind of a romance behind coal mining.
Do you think politicians romanticize mining?
They do. And for example, you know, in 2008, which would have been one of the biggest booms of my mining career as far as the industry itself, coal only made up 4% of Kentucky's economy. And if you look at the way politics are played around the industry, you would think that it was the majority of the state's economy. And so I do think politicians, you know, either romanticize or blow things out of proportion, you know, for their own means. Because an industry that's only 4% of a state's economy shouldn't play as large of a role in the state's politics.
Where do you think that leaves us now?
I don't see a long future in coal. You know, there have been a few mines that have opened up recently in my hometown. Regardless, I don't see those being long-term jobs. And as unfortunate as it is, the people in those communities understand that. The decline of the coal industry is all based on market changes. You've got to look at the price of natural gas, which I think was one of the biggest heavy hitters in the change of the industry, but also the decline of the steel industry. The fact that solar, wind, and hydro is now a more affordable option for energy compared to coal. And then also the export market is beginning to disappear because you have countries such as China and Australia opening up new coal mines. So we're also losing the ability to export the coal. It's all about, you know, profit margin and how to make an extra dollar.
Despite President Trump's promises to revive the coal industry, solar power companies in the U.S. actually employ more people. Solar power provides less than 1% of energy consumed in the U.S., but the industry has more than 300,000 workers. And there are plenty of people betting on solar power's expansion, including Google with its new Project Sunroof, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But first, we asked you to share your experiences with solar energy with us. Wade Smith installed his own panels in Indiana.
We just pulled the trigger. Racks are installed, panels are up. We should be online by the end of the month. We've been planning to install solar for over a decade, and not in some theoretical sense that fossil fuels will give way to solar in some distant future, but in a sense that we need to buy land with good southern exposure. We researched solar options with installers and equipment providers for 2 years before getting a quote last year, and we got our second and final quote about a month ago after our state, Indiana, passed a bill to essentially end net metering. So what have we learned so far? Most people don't realize the obvious, which is that an infinite number of solar panels still requires some sort of energy storage or a utility willing to provide you power at night. Therefore, there is a role for the electric company. We pay $40 for our first watt of power each month as a base service charge. That $40 is my battery and insurance plan in the event the sun doesn't shine when I need electricity, a much cheaper option than if I had to buy a ton of batteries on my own. I don't know if my utility company is going to look forwards and go big into energy storage at some point, look backwards and try to pass rules that limit net metering, or stick their head in the sand and realize in a few years that large swaths of their customers are moving towards off-grid solutions. Some households will never be able to go solar. They don't have the knowledge, capital, interest, or southern exposure. So there's always going to be a role for a utility company. But if utility companies aren't careful, many people will drop off the grid once a good battery technology that's cheap comes along. That's going to make everything more expensive for those who remain.
Shannon Plank got some help with her home solar. Her family paid nothing down to have panels installed and saves money even with the rent they pay to the solar company.
Currently, we save about $100 a month. We do have to give a small rental fee to our company. It works for us because we were unable to make a down payment because we both work full-time and have two kids and student loans, and we don't have a lot of extra cash lying around, so this was a very exciting chance for us to save a couple $1,000s a year.
You heard Wade Smith mention the term net metering. What that means is crediting homeowners for the electricity their solar panels add to the grid. Lots of states use net metering to get people to install solar panels. Just this week, Nevada reinstituted it, but it can be complicated. Here's Harry Atwater, a professor at Caltech, to explain.
When we have distributed generation, for example, if I have my rooftop solar installation, the power company charges me a certain rate, and there are tiered rates for the electricity it sells me. When I have my own home solar installation, some times of the day and some times of the year, I'm generating more electricity than I produce. When I have net metering, it says that I can sell that power back into the grid at some agreed upon price. This ends up being a very challenging and it's a contentious issue because the power companies are in a situation where they feel like they're being asked to take on the obligation of maintaining the reliability of the electricity grid without, you know, being able to support that through the profits that they get by selling electricity. The basic point is that we have to have some fair pricing so that the utilities are generate enough revenue to be able to support the reliable grid infrastructure that we all depend on.
So yes, public policy has a big impact on whether people install and use solar power, but not everything's in the government's hands. Here's Harry Atwater again.
There's a strong support that's bipartisan for basic scientific research. So I would say we don't have an energy policy in the United States. We do have a federal energy policy, of course, and the president has a lot to say about that, as does Congress. But we have an energy policy that's really as much impacted by the state policies as by the federal government.
That was Harry Atwater, a professor of physics and materials science at Caltech. Coal to solar power, we have a little more on energy now, with a special version of our segment Long and Short, where we borrow a little language from Wall Street, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. This week, our own Molly Wood and Scott Tong are here to talk with us about energy and the news. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
We're doing this sort of energy-flavored long and short, and I guess, Molly, why don't you lead us off?
I am long on Google's Project Sunroof initiative, which is now adding a new element, which is peer pressure. So Project Sunroof is sort of its initiative to encourage people to use solar, and it would give them a little bit of a calculator, let them know how much potential for installing solar you have at your actual house. And now it has sort of combined its Google Maps and Google Earth imagery with, of course, some machine learning, and can show you a map of who else has solar installed in your neighborhood.
Yeah. So I could look you up and sort of say, oh, Molly is or isn't doing this. Well, that's interesting.
Right. And let's say you're there and you're looking at this calculator and you're thinking, I don't really want to do this whole solar thing. It seems like kind of a pain in the butt. I don't want to handle the installation. And then you might see that 10 of your neighbors all have solar and your excuses start to go away. To be fair, Google's only identified 700,000 installations in the U.S. with solar panels. So the peer pressure model only works if there are, in fact, peers to be pressuring you.
So picking up in this idea of peer pressure and taking it kind of globally, you know, we have this peer pressure on renewable energy, which is called the Paris Climate Talks. And in that deal, India has very ambitious goals, and particularly on solar. It seems like the solar story is going to be potentially a huge one in India. And this might come up with the Indian Prime Minister is going to come to Washington and meet with the president next week. You know, for a long time, India and China, these emerging economies, were thought of as, well, you know, they're the laggards. Their emissions are going to go up a long time before they start to come down. Now, because solar is so competitive in price, by some projections, it's going to be as affordable as coal within just a few years in India.
I want to actually pick up on this coal thread for a second, because we talked about coal a little earlier in the show. It's certainly been something the president has set out as a priority, and I've heard that in coal country. I know you have as well, Scott. Tell me about your long here, because you're looking at what sort of government support for coal and other energy industries?
I'm long on government support for two areas of the energy sector that are really flagging. And one of them is coal. In the next couple weeks, the Energy Department is going to be coming out with a study. A lot of people assume it's a kind of a stacked study. It's already got an answer. It just wants the study to find the answer for them. And that is that coal-based power is very reliable. That is, at a power plant, you have piles of coal next to it. And so coal has a particular advantage in the energy system. This is highly debatable. However, the study is probably going to show that. And it sure seems, based on the rhetoric of this administration, that it could very well lead to some kind of help for the coal industry, whether it's federal subsidies or whether it's allowing kind of coal-based electricity to charge more, something like that. I would watch out for that. The other area is nuclear power. And a couple states have already kind of bailed out nuclear power reactors that are really struggling financially. New York State has done it. And it could be a model for other states to kind of copycat and keep these nuclear power plants afloat.
I want to stay with you, Scott, for a quick second before we go back to Molly. Yep. So tell me what you are short.
I'm short on oil prices. You know, they're falling now already. OPEC countries and Russia had a deal that they were going to kind of freeze production. People on the market always thought that was a little, you know, kind of wobbly. And now we're coming off of a period where oil prices have come up a little bit, and that has brought a lot of the U.S. producers back into the market. And it seems like they're flooding the market, and it's showing up in the price.
I want to turn to Molly's short now, which takes us into a slightly different realm, away from energy into tech, because, you know, this is your bailiwick, Molly. What are you short here?
And why not? You know, I'm short. It is a hard left that we're making. I am short on Microsoft's ongoing uncoolness.
Really? You think they're going to be cool?
I think Microsoft is getting cool. And I think they're going to be cool, possibly even for like a whole next generation of kids. Microsoft has recently released its Surface laptop, which is beautiful. And they have sort of embarked on this HoloLens strategy, which is cool and hip. Right around the time that Microsoft released Windows 10, so last February of 2017, they sent out sort of a manifesto to PC makers saying, essentially, get on board. This is what we want our PC partners to start doing. And the number one thing on their list was cool designs. And they're taking this sort of Apple approach of trying to control every part of the experience, which is build beautiful hardware, integrate the software really tightly, control the whole experience, and have something that people really enjoy using. Now, I'm not going to go all the way to the point of saying that Windows 10 itself is cool, but I will tell you this, and this is purely anecdotal, but I have a friend who's a venture capitalist who goes around and meets with startups all over the country, who posted recently on Twitter that when he became a VC, board meetings at these startups were all ThinkPad. Around 2010, they became majority MacBooks. And then he tweeted that the last meeting he was at was majority Surface.
Marketplace's Molly Wood and Scott Tong, thank you both so much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We love to hear from you about stories you've heard on the show. And last week, we heard how parents are coping with childcare over the long summer months. Rachel Jessiquel reached out to us with her story that stretches beyond school vacation.
The summer months aren't the only time that parents face challenges when it comes to finding affordable childcare. In fact, for many families like mine, childcare is a constant stress. It's a concern that we juggle 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year in and year out. I'm a mother of two kids and two stepkids, ages 2, 7, 13, and 16, living in Beaverton, Oregon. There are great camps and educational activities offered in my area during the summer, but unfortunately, I can't afford to send my kids to any of them. The childcare programs available for my youngest are extraordinarily expensive, and even the lowest costing ones are $200 a week per child. That's out of my price range. Our options aren't much better during the rest of the year. Too many parents are struggling to figure out how to ensure their kids are cared for during the day and earn an income to support them. My husband is an electrician, and I used to work in retail, but as our family grew, my minimum wage paycheck couldn't cover the nearly $1,200 a month childcare costs in my area. Eventually, I had to forego our second income and stay home to care for my kids. Now my husband and I live in fear that our rent will go up because we don't have enough money saved to finance a move. Summer childcare is just the tip of the iceberg. We need a real investment in care programs all year round. And parents in all industries and fields, including child care workers themselves, need a wage that affords them access to child care and the ability to keep their jobs. Something has to change.
If you have a comment about anything you hear on the show or have an idea of a topic we should cover, get in touch. Our email is weekend@marketplace.org. We're on Twitter at @MarketplaceWKND. You can subscribe to our newsletter. Find those details at marketplace.org. And listen to us any time of the week. You can find Marketplace Weekend wherever fine podcasts are found. As you may know, we here at Marketplace are all about numbers. We like to make sense of the news and the economy by putting them into context. That's why we do the week's news by the numbers. Marketplace's Eliza Mills and Tony Wagner take care of that. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
14.4 million.
That's how many dollars Kim Kardashian West's makeup line, KKW Beauty, made just 10 minutes after launch this week.
One of the 300,000 contour kits will set you back $48, but too late. They've already sold out.
Kardashian's 101 million Instagram followers and reality show fan base give her some serious marketing power.
Not a bad way to start challenging some of the more established beauty brands.
27.
That's how many extra cents shipping company UPS will charge residential customers for packages delivered this holiday season.
The Wall Street Journal reported that between November 19th and December 2nd, people shipping with UPS will pay an extra surcharge for ground and air deliveries.
Paying more for shipping on Black Friday and Cyber Monday sounds like a rough deal, but it may be good for seasonal employment.
UPS hired 95,000 seasonal workers last year. Passing shipping costs along to customers could mean better compensation for that staff. 300,000.
That's how many dollars worth of avocados were stolen from an Oxnard, California farm.
Three men who work at the produce company were charged with grand theft fruit this week.
The avocado burglars had been slowly stealing the equivalent of about 6,000 boxes and selling the fruit at half price.
Holy guacamole, that is a lot of avocado toast.
A little over a year ago, the UK voted to leave the European Union. This is what then Prime Minister David Cameron had to say.
The British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction.
Incoming Prime Minister Theresa May arrives at the official residence in Downing Street.
I have just been to Buckingham Palace, where Her Majesty the Queen has asked me to form a new government, and I accepted.
And what Prime Minister May also accepted was the task of seeing Britain through its divorce from the EU. So fast forward to this past week and the official start of Brexit negotiations. But as with all things in life, there are options. And for the UK, one of those might be emulating Norway, which kind of sort of has a relationship with the EU. Call it the Norway option. And for some reason, when I say that, it sounds like the title of a spy thriller or a Jason Bourne movie or whatever. But anyway, we got Marketplace's European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard, to explain how the Norway option might work.
Norway is not a member of the European Union, but since most of its trade is with the EU, it joined something called the European Economic Area. There are two other, even smaller, non-EU countries, Iceland and Liechtenstein, that have also joined. It means that even though they're not in the EU, they are in the EU's single market. They can trade freely with the 28 member states without facing tariff or non-tariff barriers. They can operate as if they were in their own domestic market.
But how does that differ then from full membership in the EU?
It's much more limited. There are pluses and minuses here. Taking Norway as the example, Norway keeps control of its own farming and fisheries, very important for the Norwegians culturally, if not economically. In return for access to the single market, Norway pays a smaller amount into the EU as a kind of budget contribution, smaller than it would as a full member, although it must be said not much smaller. But also, crucially, it can strike its own free trade deals with countries outside the EU. You can't do that if you're a full EU member. And the EU, let's face it, hasn't been fantastically good at striking trade deals. It doesn't have one with the US or with China, for example. So Norway has more freedom of action on the trade front.
And if the Brits are looking at this as a model, what are the drawbacks? Where are the catches?
because it's not a member of the European Union, Norway has no say over EU policy or EU regulations. And the whole point or the whole thrust of the single market has been harmonising rules and regulations across the bloc so there's a level playing field for all European businesses. Norway has no influence, no vote over that process, so its businesses could be at a disadvantage. As far as trade deals are concerned, yes, they can strike their own trade deals, but they're also, because any imports that come into Norway have to be subject to the EU single market rules and regulations. And some Norwegians say that's a tremendous difficulty. They have encountered problems, for example, doing business with the US because of EU trade barriers.
You know, another part of this when we talk about the single market is this idea of not just the free flow of capital, but free movement of people, citizens,
absolutely,
you know, within the EU moving around. If we look at the Norway option, doesn't that sort of run up against the sentiment of many Britons saying that they want stricter controls on immigration?
Yes, absolutely. As a member of the single market, Norway and the other two smaller countries have to accept the automatic right of EU citizens to come and settle in their country. Yes, that is a problem for the Brits. I mean, on a per capita basis, Norway actually has seen almost three times more EU migrants coming into their country than Britain has. So given last year's referendum in the UK, that is certainly a problem.
You know, I'm asking you these questions, of course, because we're looking at this as a potential model for Britain as we are in this period of negotiation. Can we handicap this? Is this a likely outcome?
Is it going to happen? Do you know, it's very, very difficult at this stage. In fact, impossible to say what's going to happen. Prime Minister May said before the election, we want to take back control of our borders, that's immigration, our laws and our taxpayers' money. Membership of the single market would not deliver any of those objectives. But that's what May said before the election. Now she's lost her parliamentary majority. She's buffeted on all sides. And, you know, frankly, Lizzie, almost anything, including her resignation, another election, and even another referendum on EU membership is possible between now and March the 29th, 2019, when the UK is scheduled to leave the EU.
Marketplace's European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard. As always, Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
June is LGBTQ Pride Month in the US. It's traditionally when Pride marches and events are celebrated. This week, we're bringing back a story from our archives about what it's like to be out at work. It can be a complex road to navigate, even for people who are out and proud in their personal lives. First up, we have Dina Fadas, the director of the Human Rights Campaign's Workplace Equality Program. I asked her about the decisions people make to be out or not out at work and how that affects both employees and the companies they work for.
In the last decade and a half of our work, so many businesses have come to the realization that being an LGBT inclusive employer isn't just the right thing to do, it's actually smart business. And so we've seen a tremendous amount of tangible progress with a majority, for example, of the Fortune 500 having specific workplace protections in place on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. Despite all of this incredible change in terms of policies and partner benefits, still a little over half of all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender workers in this country remain closeted on the job. And so quite literally, people are getting married on the weekends and not talking about it come Monday morning.
You have written about the cost of being closeted. Put it in numbers. What's your argument for the costs of staying closeted at work?
We aggregated several factors that fit broadly under what's known as employee engagement. So essentially, how enthusiastic are you about your job? What are you giving to your job? Do you see yourself staying with this employer for a long time? And we saw an aggregated drop of approximately 30% in employee engagement that really is owed to the closet, or in some cases, what we would note are unwelcoming work environments. In other words, somebody is out, they're out about their LGBT identity, but they're feeling that sense of isolation.
How do you square your advocacy work with the law? I mean, 29 states don't have any explicit laws protecting people from workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. So you can say, well, there are costs to staying in the closet, but oh my goodness, if you're going to lose your job, that seems like a huge potential cost to coming out.
For sure, the legal environment has an impact on people's decisions to be out in the workplace. And, you know, taking a step back, we hear so much, for example, about millennials. You know, this is the generation that's the most out. It's almost a non-issue. And yet, in our research, we find that actually many of the youngest workers are out to their friends and family. They're out in their school environments, and they're actually going back in the closet when they get their first jobs. And that's because they don't feel that they necessarily have that professional profile, and they don't feel able to bring their whole selves to their first jobs. And so certainly to answer your question directly, it's the legal environment, but it's also the everyday environment. Many of our survey respondents noted that they feared they would lose connections with their coworkers, they would make people feel uncomfortable, and really citing that more nuanced daily reality of what it means to be accepted or what it means to be given, you know, maybe less overt signals that, hey, you're welcome here, but we'd like you to hang up a certain part of you at the door when you come into the office.
One of the time-tested ways to do well at work is, you know, to identify a mentor, to talk to knowledgeable people. When you talk about millennials who are maybe going back in the closet, what are they losing out on if they do that at work? Are they cutting themselves off from some of maybe those mentoring relationships or other relationships in the workplace?
By nature, a lot of mentoring relationships go beyond the work at hand. In other words, your mentor is somebody who you can confide in, you can talk about personal struggles, and this is where we get into a bit of a catch-22. If you are 23 years old and in your first job and you overhear the guys at the coffee machine making wisecracks about gay people, you're simultaneously thinking, well, am I really accepted here as an out gay person? Well, maybe not. It would be that very conversation you'd want to have with a mentor. And so I think that's where you see a bit of a cycle taking place. At the same time, particularly amongst the larger businesses, these LGBT, or sometimes called LGBT and allied affinity groups, provide a tremendously effective platform for young people to find a mentor.
There was a recent study from Princeton that said coming out on your resume can be beneficial, or at least harmless. They cited for African-American men in particular. Have you found this to be true?
It really depends. And I know that that's not the soundbite answer, but it really just depends. On the one hand, we hear back from people whose decision to be out on their resume was both tied to their skill sets. You know, I wanted to demonstrate that I took this leadership role in a network group, but also as a way to, in no uncertain terms, communicate with a prospective employer. My expectation is that everything I'm bringing to the table, including my LGBT identity, is something that I want to be valued here. At the same time, we also know from our research that bias happens, whether it's conscious or unconscious. We're not usually in a position to advise one way or another, but rather to equip people with the knowledge and the tools that we can so that they can make the best informed decision for their, be it their first job, their second job, or if they're later in their careers.
So some kid comes to you and says, what do I do? Do I come out at work? Is it always a yes or?
It's a conversation. It's a conversation as to, one, is there any reason you haven't been out yet? Is there any reason why from day one you didn't feel that you could bring this part of your identity to the workplace? And then from there, we can talk a bit more concretely.
Dina Fidas is the director of the Human Rights Campaign's Workplace Equality Program. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Back in 2014, when we first aired this interview, the Human Rights Campaign had just released its annual Corporate Equality Index, which keeps track of the way businesses treat LGBTQ employees. You can see this year's numbers on our website at marketplace.org. We're going to continue our discussion of coming out at work. To get a better sense of people's experiences in the workplace, we spoke with a few people about coming out at their jobs. Of course, there's no one portrait of what it's like to be out in the workplace, but here's a look. Sam Ritchie is an online communications expert. For him, being out at work is fairly simple.
I've been out pretty much since high school, so I never really had a formal coming out process. And I just start talking about my life. I talk about boyfriends or when I was married, my husband, and people just pick up on it. I work in nonprofit, and so I've had a lot of jobs for LGBT organizations. So I just joke that it's being professionally gay to work for those kinds of places. I do sort of try to get a feel that it would be a welcoming place. I certainly wouldn't go somewhere that seemed like it would be closed or closed-minded or where I would feel like I'd have to hide that part of myself. I definitely feel closer to people because I'm able to be honest about my life. I mean, if I wasn't able to talk about my personal life, I feel like I would come across as very guarded and not, you know, friendly or you know, open with people.
Anne-Marie Whalen is an oncology nurse. Being out to her coworkers is important to her. But with her patients, things are different.
I don't come out to my patients because we're in this sort of power dynamic where I have a lot of control over their lives. I'm the one who is responsible to make sure that they're okay and that they get their medications and that, you know, they get their dressings changed and they get the care that they need and that I'm the person who's looking out for them and making sure that they stay safe. So I want to make sure that they feel comfortable with me and I don't want to risk coming out to somebody and then having them have a problem with the fact that I'm gay and having that damage the trust that they have in me as their nurse. I work 13-hour shifts, so like you spend a lot of time with the same people. And so it's definitely nice if you can be friends with your coworkers instead of just seeing them at work. And I feel like being out at work allows me to do that.
Josie Simonis says that for her, being out isn't really a choice. But if it were, she says she'd still choose visibility.
At the very top of my CV is my full legal name, which is Joseph Simonis. And then underneath that, I typically go by Josie, and so that's listed. But then also two are my personal pronouns. So I use either she or they pronouns, and that's listed right at the top. I actually don't have a choice in terms of whether or not I'm out in the workplace or really anywhere in my life. I'm pretty visible in terms of being trans. Being out at work has definitely allowed me to be more comfortable with who I am and bring more of myself to work on a regular basis. It's also afforded me lots of opportunities to be mentored and to be a mentor to others, which allows me to be more comfortable and feel more engaged both with my workplace and with my colleagues as well.
And that is it for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez and Drew Jostad are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.